You're listening to Engage with Andy Bush. To connect with the program today, please send an email to andrew.bush@comcast.net. That's andrew.bush@comcast.net. Now, back to this week's program.
Welcome to Engage with Andy Bush. I'm your host, Andy Bush. Remember, you can subscribe to the podcast for free on iTunes. Just search for Engage with Andy Bush in the iTunes store. If you'd like more information on today's show and its guests, visit andrewbush.com or follow me on Twitter at @abush. In this segment, we cover the U.S. economy and where it's headed with Jack Ablin. Jack is the chief investment officer and former colleague of mine at BMO Private Bank in Chicago. Jack, welcome back to Engage.
Thanks, Andy.
Hey, Jack, in your latest report entitled Outlook for the Financial Markets, you looked at the average quarterly U.S. data over the last 10 years. What did you find?
I found that statistically, the first quarter continually disappoints us. And it's not just simply seasonal adjustments. It seems as though... For whatever reason, there's always a disappointment in the first quarter, at least over the last 10 years.
You know, my mom always used to say that about me. So. But yeah, it's really strange, especially the last 2 years. It's really come to light because of the weather. But what you're saying is over the last 10 years, it's really the big child that's underperformed.
Yeah, I mean, by more than a couple percentage points. It's really pretty consistently lackluster. So I do think that the government does need to make some kind of an adjustment. Perhaps there's something related to taxes and spending. I really can't explain it, but it is pretty poor.
That's interesting. So with that in mind, I guess that's why economists anticipate growth will resume for the rest of the year.
Yeah, I think that's certainly part of it. And I will say we can look at the weather. It was pretty ugly. I think the Northeast got the most snow that they've ever gotten. And I think that, you know, we did have some isolated labor disputes in certain key areas of the country. So I think that certainly is all behind us. We probably will get a boost going into Q2. And certainly if you just look at the labor market, it would suggest that things are rocking and rolling.
Well, also, I would say internationally, we know that there's a nice story there with France, Italy, and Spain all recording growth rates together for the first time since 2010. And Japan had a great Q1 growing at 2.4%. But I guess the question I have for you is, you know, can they keep it going, or do you expect them to slow down as the U.S. gains momentum?
Yeah, and that, I would say, Andy, I'm not an economist, but that is one of the things that does keep me awake at night. And I wonder, you know, is there enough growth to go around to make all of the countries happy, or is this simply just, you know, teeter-totter your currency, shift growth in your direction, and then, you know, lose it as soon as your currency rallies back again. So it's really hard to know if this is an organic recovery or if this is some sort of what we'll call a market share recovery, where growth overall is not trending at a rate that policymakers would like to see. So instead, we're taking market share from others to try to achieve those numbers.
Well, certainly with China, that's one of the areas I know that you've been concerned about for some time. You know, they've obviously just come out this week and said they're actually, the People's Bank of China reduced its growth rate from 7.1% to 7%, which I don't know about you, but I think they're somewhere south of 5% in reality. What do you think the story there is? Do you expect this slow growth period to continue? What's your risk profile for them?
Yeah, I do worry a little bit about China. You're right. We look at, you know, electric consumption, for example, running at around 5%. So, you know, unless they've become all of a sudden substantially more energy efficient, it's hard for me to reconcile a 7% overall growth rate if your electricity usage is only growing at 5%. But be that as it may, let's assume that 7% is the right number. The interesting thing, Andy, is if you take global growth last year and subtract out China and subtract out the U.S., you end up with something about 0.5% of growth for everybody else. It's really been skewed toward the number one, two largest economies in the world right now.
Yeah, and certainly with the slowdown in China, that takes that number down. Overall, global growth has slowed primarily because of the lack of growth in China. So, you know, and this is a really good point. And so I want to talk about the bond market because that also has been one of the drivers of lower bond yields overall. But you did another excellent piece of analysis in your outlook by looking at the 10-year growth rates of debt in the United States to see if there's a credit bubble forming. Which sectors grew, Jack, and does this growth point to a bubble?
I would say no. I mean, for the most part, if you look at debt growth, divided by sector, remarkably, household debt has actually come down. Over the last 10 years, mortgage debt is down $1.1 trillion. Credit card debt is down $600 or $700 billion. There are pockets of growth in debt. We're seeing auto loans expand. We're now selling nearly 17 million autos a year, at least on that run rate basis. Mm-hmm. Of course, we're seeing school loans expand, and that's mirroring these high tuition prices. So, there is some growth, but overall household debt has actually come down as Americans have shored up their balance sheet. The one sector of the bond market that has expanded far in excess of nominal GDP growth, and that's federal debt. We're still back to that. I think ultimately, if you want to talk politics, I mean, the Republicans can flap all their arms they want about, conservatism and everything else, but eventually, meanwhile, the Democrats and others are piling up this debt load. Eventually, the Democrats are going to get their way because we're going to have to pay this debt back, and taxes are going to have to go up, and all of a sudden, guess who pays for it's going to be the income earners that pay for that excess debt.
Yeah, and there's a balance to be struck, certainly, because you can't raise taxes so much that you depress economic growth because then you hurt your tax revenues overall, which is a major problem for the United States. And certainly with the Federal Reserve and their quantitative easing program, how much debt that they've sucked up overall has really masked the growth in U.S. Federal government debt overall, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would say it has. I mean, the Federal Reserve has been the biggest buyer of government debt, certainly made a lot of the auction programs go much smoother than they would have if they had to face real buyers. As a result of that, we've got 10-year Treasury yields still substantially below nominal GDP. Keep in mind, historically, 10-year Treasury should be roughly pegged to nominal GDP. And if you assume, even conservatively, Andy, nominal GDP at the lowest should be 3.5%, and is probably closer to 4%, which says to me that at 2.5% 10-year, even though rates have gone pretty much straight up this quarter, there's still a lot more to go to the upside.
So that's your outlook. Where do you see the 10-year yield topping out?
I think, first of all, I think anything lower than 3.5% in the 10-year is still cheap.
Okay.
So I do think that the 10-year can get to 3% this year. I don't think that that's necessarily going to snuff out an incipient recovery. I don't think it's going to necessarily pull the rug out from under the equity markets. Mm-hmm. The simple fact is the 10-year treasuries and the entire treasury curve is just aggressively too expensive, meaning that yields are just too low based on the environment, and that needs to correct itself.
And certainly they've been pricing in a rate hike for September, and some believe that it could be as late as December. Where you come down on that? What's your most likely outcome for the Fed?
Yeah, I think my most likely outcome for the Fed is a one and done in September. I think the Fed wants to put the markets on notice that they are entering a tightening cycle. But at the same time, unlike her predecessors, Chairwoman Yellen does not want to tip her hand as to her plan for raising rates in the future, and largely because she doesn't really know. If we rewind back to, say, 1994, in periods where Greenspan Fed started tightening rates, one of the things he did was he pretty well started the rate hike and then telegraphed to the entire world what his plans for rate hikes were, so that even though rates were rising, the simple fact that everybody knew what that that course of action was, that risk has actually come down. And that's why, you know, he ended up scratching his head wondering, you know, why is it that we're taking all this risk while rates are rising? Is because he pretty much, you know, handed out his playbook.
Yeah, and there wasn't the you're not sure if you're going to get a 2x4 up the side of the head from the Fed in that program, unlike under Paul Volcker.
Right, exactly. And that's it. I mean, the fact is that, you know, equities trade on an equity risk premium. And when the world is certain, the equity risk premium is going to come down, as we've seen. When we start to, you know, create some uncertainty or a little bit of imbalance between what the Fed's going to do or what our funding costs are going to look like over the next 18 months, then equity risk premium has to widen a little bit. So you're going to see, for example, small caps underperforming large caps. You'll see that, you know, the growthy or go-go names underperforming some of the more stable names. But I think overall, I don't necessarily think that the equity market has to correct that much, because I think that even though equities are expensive by traditional measures, there's one lens you can look through to make equities look cheap, and that's bonds.
Right. So overall, that's the dynamic. So what, you know, I think in the newsletter that you put out, you feel that S&P 500 is overvalued here at 2100. Well, why do you think that? I mean, is that just looking at what metrics are you using to analyze the S&P here?
Sure. So one of my favorite metrics to use on a valuation history is price to sales.
Okay.
And relative to price to sales, the S&P 500 is trading about 27% above its median. And so the only period where we had a consistent price to sales ratio higher than we are right now was the end of 1999, early 2000.
Wow.
So it is you know, rather stretched. If I were to take a ratio, a relationship between price to sales ratio and the subsequent 3-year price return of the market, you get, not surprisingly, an inverse relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And if we take the, I think we're at a 1.83 or somewhere thereabouts, price to sales ratio. If we take that number and plug it in to that analysis, we're going to get something like a negative 3% annualized return for the next 3 years, price only. So if you take that and then add another 2% dividend, you end up with about, you know, essentially a wash, a flat market over the next 3 years.
You know, that makes a lot of sense to me, because I just, you know, looking out into the world, it's just really hard to invest in U.S. domestic equities, given the fact that yes, we're growing, but with the growth, you're beginning to see wage pressures, and you're also beginning to have the Federal Reserve raise interest rates.
Yeah, and that's it. I mean, one of the reasons, the counter-arguments, a critic could argue against my case and say, well, you know what, the price-to-sales ratio doesn't take profit margins into account. In other words, price-to-sales ratio assumes a kind of a mean reverting profit margin environment, and that's, you know, and that's true. And the fact is, right now, price to the margins, I should say, are at near all-time highs. Certainly, cyclical highs at nearly 10% for the S&P 500. Okay, so let's assume that. But okay, what's coming along? I mean, we have higher wages. We're now starting to see commodity prices pick up a little bit, and interest rates are rising. So I'm not sure how I can get wider margins based on the flow of data that's coming at us right now. And I would argue that during the course of Q2, Q3, and even into Q4 possibly, we could see tighter margins, narrower margins, and that's going to put additional pressure on that price-to-sales ratio.
All right. We covered it all today with Jack Ablin from BMO Private Bank. Thanks for joining us, Jack.
Thank you, Andy.
All right, you bet. Have a good weekend. If you would like more information on today's show and its guests, visit andrewbush.com or follow me on Twitter at ABUSCH. Let's grab a donut and take a break. I'm Andy Bush. You're listening to Engage.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Does your organization lack proper leadership? We're not necessarily talking about experience, but about how to face the changing dynamic of leadership today. Sometimes the people we lead know more. Old ways don't work anymore, and the comfort zone just becomes too easy. listen for Out of the Comfort Zone with Dr. Wanda Wallace. We'll show you how you can adapt and develop your leadership skills to today's workplace every Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Time on Voice America Business.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.